what he was going through. But Trent was also feeling physically ill from a sharp pain in his left hip. "We would sometimes sit and talk with each other about how bad it felt," McMonagall recalls. The army threatened McMonagall with probation for his weight problem. The military does not tolerate soldiers who are physically unfit. McMonagall started having steroid shots at Kimbrough Army Hospital across the street. The pain got so bad, he says, he took up meditation, then started seeing a Chinese doctor who performed acupuncture. "I started to get better," McMonagall recalls. But Hartley Trent got worse. When Tess revealed Trent had Hodgkin's disease, McMonagall felt devastated. A black cloud descended. Trent endured radiation and chemotherapy treatments, but modern medicine could not stop the cancer from invading his body. McMonagall struggled with ominous feelings. His second marriage was moving toward separation and divorce. On the way to work one morning, he was involved in a multi-car pileup on I-95 and narrowly missed dying. The Army and the CIA believed, or at least wanted him to believe, that he had extraordinary human powers, a sixth sense, or ability to see things other people could not physically see, and that it was his job, his duty, to develop these abilities. But on the human front, he was as frail as the guy in the next cubicle. He couldn't make a marriage work, believe he was a good father, or live free of physical pain. Now his friend was dying right in front of him, and there was nothing he or anyone else could do. When Hartley Trent was taking his last breaths, McMonagall was standing beside his bed along with Hartley's wife. His end was near, McMonagall recalls. His eyes suddenly popped open and he smiled at us. Then, after a moment, he spoke. "It's really quite beautiful where I'm going," he said. He closed his eyes and died. "No more pain," McMonagall remembers. "For me, there was a very large hole." McMonagall could not stop thinking about the nature of grief and how soldiers deal with sorrow. "What happens to all this grief?" he wondered. "You put it away somewhere, in the back of your mind, bury it under layers of calloused scarring from years of accumulated experiences. Soldiers are told to be tough, not to be crushed by experience, however painful those experiences may be. A soldier learns to use his or her grief as a motivator," he says. But from McMonagall's perspective, there was one thing soldiers rarely do. They never take the time to process the loss. They suck it up and move on, putting one foot in front of the other, he says. Over time, the grief they've accumulated and buried becomes so great it can never be processed. Opening the door to those feelings would be like splitting the face of a dam. Once the water started to flow, there would be no way to stop it. And so Joe McMonagall put the deep feelings of sorrow and loss of his friend Hartley Trent in the same place he put similar feelings about friends he'd lost in Vietnam. One foot in front of the other, one remote viewing session after the next. He was the only one left to conduct operational sessions now, and his stress levels skyrocketed, he says. During this difficult time, Fred Atwater came up with an idea, something to help him relax. Fred suggested I accompany him to a place called the Monroe Institute, McMonagall recalls. It was a New Age retreat in the Blue Ridge Mountains, run by a 76-year-old guru named Robert Monroe. Monroe was a peculiar figure, someone who for the first half of his adult life lived a conservative existence as a radio executive, and then, in his mid-40s, abruptly retired and immersed himself in consciousness studies and the supernatural. Monroe's mentor in these pursuits was Andrea Puharic, who, according to Monroe, taught him how to alter his consciousness on demand. The result, Monroe said, was an out-of-body experience, or OBE. The mystical idea of an out-of-body experience is rooted in religion and has many names. Hindu scripture describes yoganandas who perform astral projection. Ancient Egyptian texts refer to a second non-physical body or subtle body called ka. The YY people of Brazil called it soul flight. In The Secret of the Golden Flower, an 8th century Chinese handbook on alchemy and meditation, out-of-body experiences are referred to as travel to the celestial sphere. Bob Monroe's modern out-of-body experiences were of a much more plebeian kind. Monroe claimed to be able to leave his body and travel to very specific places here on Earth, including the kitchens and bedrooms of various friends and acquaintances. In his memoir, he wrote that Andrea Puharic was one of his early test targets. Desiring to be repertorial and objective, Monroe kept a record of his experiences, he said. In a journal entry dated May 5, 1961, he wrote, "Applied mental liftoff and concentrated mental desire to visit Dr. Puharic in California. After a short trip, stopped in a room. There was a long, narrow table with several chairs and bookshelves. There was a man sitting at the table writing on paper. He resembled Dr. Puharic. I greeted him, and he looked up and smiled." Later, Monroe checked in with Puharic. "The locale was right and actions were correct, but he has no memory of the visit," Monroe wrote. But the more Monroe practiced leaving his physical body, the better he became at it, he said. "Everyone has a second body," he wrote, "one that can travel around at will." He planned to keep track of his OBEs and write a best-selling book. It did not take long for Monroe's out-of-body experiences to take a salacious turn. During one experience, he desired to have sex with his wife, he wrote, but she was sound asleep next to him in their bed, he said, so he branched out with his second body and began enjoying sex with numerous women on the astral plane. Monroe described each experience as unbearable ecstasy, but also as ordinary as shaking hands. When Monroe's wife, Mary, found out, she made copies of her husband's journal entries and gave them to Puharic, ostensibly for his opinion as a medical doctor. According to Monroe's biographer, Ronald Russell, Mary never heard back from Puharic, who wrote about Monroe's sexual escapades in his own book, Beyond Telepathy, published in 1962. In it, Puharic declared Monroe's out-of-body experiences were a fraud. "Monroe had a drug habit," he wrote, "which involved sniffing model airplane glue." Puharic surmised that Monroe was merely simulating out-of-body escapades while high on drugs, an ironic instance of the pot calling the kettle black. When Monroe read about himself in Beyond Telepathy, he became furious and told his lawyer he wanted to sue Puharic for libel. The attorney advised against this on the ground that a jury might instead question Monroe's sanity. In the end, Monroe decided not to sue. "The woolly world of consciousness expansion does not necessarily include integrity, empathy, or honesty," Monroe said. Bob Monroe published his own book in 1971, Journeys Out of the Body, in which he described his experiences on the astral plane. The book became a hit, selling more than 100,000 copies. Now Monroe had an audience to which he could market and sell a product he'd patented, an audio tape of binaural beats he'd trademarked as HemiSync, short for Hemispheric Synchronization. The concept was more than a century old, built on the work of Heinrich W. Dove, a Prussian physicist who proposed the concept of the binaural beat in 1839. The idea was that when two pure tones of slightly different frequencies are played, one in each ear, the brain perceives the difference between the two signals as a third phantom sound. According to Monroe, listening to his tapes produced a state of mind conducive to astral projection. HemiSync, he said, was a gateway to another level of consciousness, not awake, but also not asleep. Across America, people wanted to have the same kinds of experiences Bob Monroe enjoyed, so he opened the Monroe Institute and became a celebrity in parapsychology circles. Monroe's ideas were far out and unorthodox. He promoted the idea that life after death was real, and that with enough HemiSync training, clients would be able to visit with dead loved ones on the other side. This was all very new age, and it was accepted in certain circles, but the U.S. Army was historically not one of them. It would be safe to say that the average taxpayer would not condone this kind of training for soldiers. In the fall of 1982, however, in his capacity as branch chief, Skip Atwater thought the Monroe Institute would be a good place for Joe McMonagle to learn how to relax. McMonagle agreed and became the Institute's first official U.S. Army client. Soon, hundreds of INSCOM personnel would follow. A 30-minute drive from Charlottesville, Virginia, in the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains, the Monroe Institute sits on 800 acres surrounded by dense forest and rolling hills. In the winter of 1983, Fred Atwater accompanied Joe McMonagle there with the goal of helping remote viewer 001, as he was designated, learn to relax deeply. After a week-long seminar, McMonagle returned home feeling different, he says. He slept a little better, felt less stressed, and seemed better able to focus. After a second trip to Monroe, McMonagle recalls experiencing a shift. There was a noticeable difference in my remote viewing, he says. Atwater suggested that McMonagle write a report and request more time at the Institute. Permission granted, he began a 14-week intensive course in pursuit of a new goal. With Bob Monroe, McMonagle would develop a system to have and repeat the out-of-body experience. Things started to really open up, says McMonagle. Atwater was pleased and encouraged him to write another review. This time, McMonagle produced a very positive 10-page classified report, encouraging his commanding officers at INSCOM to allow other soldiers to learn how to expand their consciousness and have out-of-body experiences at the Monroe Institute. Intellectual horizons would be broadened and new concepts of perception would be unavoidable, McMonagle wrote. Light and heavy emotion-packed responses will result from the intensive HemiSync tape experience. This experience can be expected to alter the participant's personality with regard to interpersonal relationships. McMonagle cautioned that Monroe's program was not ideal for the average military-minded individual unless participants across the board are willing and urged to divest themselves of peer pressure, rank consciousness, and ego-based self-protectiveness, he warned. The experience is intended to expand man's consciousness and broaden his perception of reality. If a soldier couldn't accept this, the experience of the whole would be seriously diluted. In hindsight, this is where a red flag should have been raised. The Army was and remains, by its very nature, military-minded. Coupling Army doctrine with expanding consciousness and shifting perceptions of reality was a potentially catastrophic mix. But Fred Atwater was not the only officer at INSCOM working with Bob Monroe. So was Lieutenant Colonel John Alexander, director of General Burt Stubblebine's Advanced Human Technology Office. In the winter of 1983, in search of human technologies to enhance soldier performance and shrink the technology gap, the Army Science Board hosted a retreat at the Monroe Institute to discuss strategies and actions which improve human capability, potential, and performance. Bob Monroe was one of four speakers to address the attendees. In documents declassified by the CIA, Monroe told Army Science Board advisors that in the 5 years his institute had been in business, he had personally conducted 4,823 experiments on 1,200 individuals. The results, he said, illustrated that the electrical effect of hemisync simulated the brain to induce certain changes in the biological sphere of influence, including the ability to cause sleep, cause wakefulness, increase concentration, increase recall of information, reduce stress, decrease pain, and increase speed of healing following surgery or injury. Cognitive benefits included enhanced reading skills, rapid vocabulary learning, improved decision-making, improved problem-solving, and improved muscular control. All the things General Stubblebine was looking for. A second advisory team, not affiliated with Stubblebine's High Performance Task Group, was sent to the Institute to assess the results of the HemiSync tape seminar. This group rejected Monroe's claims. In findings presented to Pentagon officials on April 18, 1983, the team found that exposure to the sleep tape did not appear to aid sleep, and wakefulness effects were not convincingly demonstrated. As for enhanced cognition and medical claims, concentration benefits were not convincingly demonstrated, and medical claims and effects were not supported by scientifically acceptable studies, only testimonial-type comments. The Defense Intelligence Agency asked the Central Intelligence Agency to weigh in. The CIA assigned Kit Green the job. Green read the reports, examined the data, and made a general assessment. Altered states make the brain unstable, he said, and can have effects similar to hallucinogens. Enhancing an altered state in pursuit of intelligence collection, he wrote, would likely produce more noise and less signal. The CIA recommended to DIA that the Army disengage from its partnership with the Monroe Institute. General Stubblebine read the CIA's recommendation. He disagreed and overruled it. In an interview in 2016, Dr. Green stated that he believed what General Stubblebine was doing was dangerous. And that is where I started diverting from Dale Graff and Hal Puthoff and others. I do not believe you can train a soldier to be a psychic spy, Green insists. I had conducted enough experiments with a few people, i.e. Uri Geller, Ingo Swann, and Pat Price, that it was clear to me that the phenomenology that had to do with remote viewing was, from time to time, 100% accurate, meaning that in certain people, it was phenomenal in the literal sense of the word. I felt that what I had found was that the people who were almost always right and were doing the things that were the most dramatic, the Sugar Grove experiments, the experiments with Uri Geller, Pat Price's experiments, those were not average human beings. They were much smarter than the average human being. I looked at their blood tests, their genetic tests, their IQ tests, their neurological tests, and their cardiovascular tests, which has a lot to do with endocrinology. I concluded that these people are abnormal. In Green's assessment, that was an indicator of why they were so good at remote viewing. Green recalls his confrontation with General Stubblebine over this issue. I said, "You cannot take young soldiers and ask them if they want to be psychic spies, and then train them in remote viewing." Green suggested what he believed was a wiser approach. Take these physiological, psychological, psychiatric, and genetic characteristics we identified at CIA, and go recruit more people like that. Stubblebine disagreed. He was convinced that ESP and PK and other forms of psychic functioning were latent in all people and could be brought out through training. And as commander of INSCOM, he had the authority to overrule Kit Green. Green's dissent, however, brought up the issue of research ethics and principles for human experimentation established by the Nuremberg Military Tribunals, i.e., the Nuremberg Code. And INSCOM was now required to create a human use review board in order to continue its training. For General Stubblebine, one hurdle remained. Monroe's patented hemisync tapes were part of a Monroe Institute seminar called Gateway, and these seminars involved daily group discussions among participants. Army intelligence personnel could not mix with the civilian population in such an open discussion environment. The Army would need its own program, an INSCOM version of Gateway. So Stubblebine arranged to have Robert Monroe's stepdaughter, Nancy Honeycutt, redesign the Gateway seminar to meet Army intelligence needs. The new program was called RAPT, Rapid Acquisition Personnel Training. At Fort Meade, word spread fast. There was a new training program being offered, one that could teach a soldier or an Army civilian how to expand their consciousness and have an out-of-body experience. Scores of Army intelligence workers signed up for RAPT. It did not take long for chaos to descend. More trouble was brewing. In January 1983, the magician James Randi's battle with Uri Geller over the issue of psychokinesis took an extraordinary turn, one that devastated the civilian parapsychology community. Since 1973, Uri Geller and James Randi had continued to appear on national talk shows, with Geller asserting that his ESP and PK powers were genuine, and Randi insisting that Geller was a magician. Unable to put Geller out of business with rhetoric or to get the public to dismiss ESP and PK as fraud, Randi decided to up his game and perpetrate a hoax against a well-known parapsychology lab in St. Louis, Missouri. Randi sent two young magicians pretending to be psychics to a privately funded institution called the McDonnell Laboratories for Psychical Research at Washington University. Stephen Shaw and Michael Edwards, told scientists there that they could use psychokinesis to bend spoons and move objects without touching them. In reality, they employed a form of prestidigitation or sleight of hand taught to them by James Randi. Over a 3-year period, the two teenagers spent a total of 5 weeks in the Washington University lab. In the meantime, Randi sent 22 letters to lab director Peter R. Phillips, warning Phillips that spoon bending could easily be faked by skilled magicians, and offering ways to share methods the lab could employ to catch people who were cheating. Phillips never took Randi up on his offer. At one point in 1982, the two magicians were dismissed from the lab on the grounds that they could not perform under certain controls, but were rehired a few months later by a different set of researchers working for the same lab. In January 1983, Randi held a press conference to announce that he had masterminded a hoax against McDonald Laboratory. When a reporter asked one of the young men, "Can you tell us how you do that?" Stephen Shaw walked up to the microphone and said, "I cheat." The room went wild, and the story generated much negative press against parapsychologists. The Washington Post called the event the slyest scientific hoax in years. Laboratory director Peter Phillips said he had trusted the research subjects and that there are ethical issues involved in lying to scientists. Randi retorted that this was exactly his point. Ray Hyman, the psychologist hired by ARPA in 1973 to evaluate Uri Geller at SRI, weighed in. Randi was very upset by Geller's using trickery to deceive scientists. He thought it was very immoral, and he felt that it was a prostitution of his beloved magic. Martin Gardner, the father of the skeptical scientific movement, also spoke out. "Paranormal metal bending is so fantastic a violation of natural laws that the first task of any competent experimenter is to determine whether a psychic who bends spoons is cheating or not." The Pentagon assigned an analyst to examine the hoax and see how it might affect its top-secret Grill Flame program. The magician James Randi claimed a lab was taken in by trickery and that most, if not all, parapsychology research is suspect, the analyst noted, but insisted that Randi's claims were gross distortions of the facts. The two magicians had been dismissed from the lab the year before, the Defense Department analyst wrote, when it became clear they could not demonstrate psychic abilities under tighter controls or formal scientific experimentation. "It is clear Mr. Randi is solely interested in promoting his image as a clever magician and in enhancing his career as a showman at the expense of reporting accuracy. The use of tactics involving plants raises ethical questions as well." As for any potential impact on Grill Flame, the analyst concluded that the bad publicity should, in fact, have an overall beneficial effect on open parapsychological laboratories that are not as tight in experimental technique and subject selection as they could be, which sounded a bit like wishful thinking. "But the hoax did affect the INSCOM program," explained Colonel John Alexander in an interview in 2016. "We started using magicians as consultants. Among the people I was involved with was Doug Henning," Alexander says. In 1983, Henning was one of the most famous magicians in the world. The first episode of Doug Henning's World of Magic in 1975 still holds the record as the most watched magic show in television history with a reported audience of over 50 million. Another individual Alexander was working with at this time, also involving psychokinesis research, was Jack Hauk, the Boeing aerospace engineer and progenitor of the PK spoonbending party. "Jack would host spoonbending parties at my house," Alexander says. Doug Henning was invited to attend. Alexander wanted the magician's expert opinion about whether some or all of a group of roughly 20 guests could collectively cheat at one of Hauk's PK parties. "There were two things that blew Henning away at a PK event at my home in Northern Virginia," Alexander recalls. "The first was the bending of a spoon by an 11-year-old girl. The other was that Henning's manager had a spontaneous bending happen, meaning that the spoon bent in his hand while he was holding it out in front of him. That meant no physical force was involved. Since it was Henning's guy, obviously we had not set him up." The controversial and contentious world of psychics, magicians, and skeptics experienced another extraordinary moment in 1987. At the height of his popularity, Doug Henning quit stage magic. He left illusion magic for what he said was real magic, the kind that science could not yet explain. Henning thereafter focused on transcendental meditation, TM, and began spending much of his time with the movement's founder, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. "Magic is something that happens that appears to be impossible," Henning told the Los Angeles Times in 1988. "What I call illusion magic uses laws of science and nature that are already known. Real magic uses laws that haven't yet been discovered." In 1999, Henning was diagnosed with liver cancer and died 5 months later. James Randi blamed his death on the Maharishi. He and his multi-million-dollar kingdom of sycophants caused the death of my friend Doug Henning, who dedicated himself to the transcendental meditation notion so deeply that he abandoned regular medical treatment for liver cancer, continued to pursue his diet of nuts and berries, and died of the disease, Randi wrote. Chapter 18. Psychic Training. Dale Graff stood on an upper floor of the partially built U.S. Embassy in Moscow, a high-powered experimental X-ray scanning machine designed by the Los Alamos National Laboratory at his feet. He stared out over the Moscow River and across the city that represented America's arch nemesis. It was 1983. Fierce winds whipped through what amounted to the shell of a building, just steel framing, floor joists, and window frames. Winter here in the Soviet capital was brutal, and the snow and wind stung his face. Graff was dressed in a mountaineer's jacket and boots and carried mountaineering ropes. Pausing for a moment, he asked himself the proverbial, "What am I doing here?" There were easy short answers, including one that had to do with his job at the Defense Intelligence Agency. Graff was in Moscow as team leader on a classified counter-espionage effort called Project Spitfire. But it was finding an answer to the bigger question that most interested him. What mystery lies behind causality, he wondered. Is there a force responsible for cause and effect? Or is a man's life a series of random events strung together from which meaning is derived? Graff considered another reason for his presence here, events that had occurred a few months earlier when he had attended lectures in the cafeteria at the new DIA headquarters at Bolling Air Force Base in Washington, D.C. DIA had a recreation club that would meet at lunchtime, Graff recalls. By 1983, I'd been taking Arctic canoe trips for almost 10 years. During lunch, I'd show Super 8 movies of me dragging my canoe over icy rivers in the Arctic tundra. Bureaucrats and analysts alike crammed into the lunchroom to hear Graff talk about his sojourns in the far north. Word got around, he recalls. Right around that time, DIA issued a solicitation for a team leader needed for a classified mission with an unusual set of qualifications. The person had to have a background in physical sciences and have a proven ability to survive in harsh winter weather, says Graff. Apparently, there was only one guy at DIA who fit the bill. Me. So here he was in Moscow, in charge of Project Spitfire, a highly classified foreign technology investigation. The CIA had received intelligence that this new embassy, being built at a cost of $200 million, $485 million in 2017, had been bugged at its core, that sensors had somehow been embedded deep inside the structural framing materials. Graff was charged with determining whether this assessment was accurate. Paranoia was high. We had to be sure, he recalls. So much was at stake. In 1983, in the middle of what seemed like an ever-escalating crisis between the world's two nuclear superpowers, the United States could not afford to falsely accuse the Soviets of espionage. At the same time, it could not afford to fall prey to a massive Soviet eavesdropping and surveillance program. The new U.S. embassy in Moscow was not just any embassy. It was going to be the most elaborate and expensive such edifice built by the United States to date. 8 stories tall and set on a 10-acre parcel overlooking the Moscow River, it would stand as a Cold War symbol of prosperity, power, and freedom. It was located right around the corner from many important Soviet Politburo buildings and a short walk from the ambassador's private residence. The negotiations on erecting the building had been going on for more than a decade. Now, finally, the United States and the Soviets had agreed on terms and construction had commenced. The Soviets were in control of fabricating the embassy's structural system, with Russian supply companies providing precast concrete blocks for the building's exterior. The Americans would be responsible for the building's finish work, including walls, flooring, windows, and doors, the places where bugging devices were traditionally hidden. When Graff arrived in Moscow, the building was still a shell. There was no elevator, nor was any stairwell complete, he recalls. We used mountain climbing ropes to get ourselves around the building, which was also how we got the X-ray machine in. This machine was the centerpiece of the counter-espionage operation, engineered by Los Alamos scientists with specifications that were classified. It weighed 400 pounds, Graff recalls, and getting it to Moscow was an arduous task. First, it had been flown from New Mexico to Helsinki on an Air Force plane. Then, it was secreted into Moscow by rail, disguised as U.S. Embassy office equipment. Graff recalls that in exchange for several cases of vodka, local construction workers helped him and his team raise the heavy machine from the street to an upper floor of the building with climbing ropes. For weeks, the Spitfire team had been using the machine to scan each concrete block for bugging devices. Soviet officials became suspicious of the machine, which they were told was checking for cracks in the concrete construction work. Each block weighed 7,000 pounds, explains Graf. The suspicion was that the Soviets had embedded sensors directly into these massive precast blocks. There were several thousand of them in total, and each had to be inspected. Back at Fort Meade, remote viewers from Det G conducted sessions to determine where Graf and his team should look for bugs. We had viewers targeting certain areas, certain pillars on specific floors, Fred Atwater recalls. The viewers' information would prove futile, but it did not take long for the members of Project Spitfire to confirm the CIA and the State Department's worst fears. Not only had the Soviets embedded sensors into the precast blocks, they had also devised a scheme whereby they mixed garbage with the concrete, which made it impossible to see high-tech sensors among the Russian trash. Thus, there was no way to identify and remove individual sensors. The embassy was, in essence, a giant antenna. First, the Moscow signal at the previous embassy, now this. There was nothing left for Graf and his team to do but pack up and head home. When the story finally broke as news 3 years later, in 1987, the Senate Committee on Intelligence described the Soviet effort as the most massive, sophisticated, and skillfully executed bugging operation in history. Back in the States, as director of the Advanced Concepts Office at DIA, Graf had an abundance of work to catch up on. When he'd left for Moscow, the Grill Flame program was on track, with two remote viewers working on intelligence operations and four individuals undergoing training with Ingo Swann. Upon his return, Graf found himself in the middle of the drama unfolding at the Monroe Institute. One of the sideline participants in the saga was a young army captain named Paul H. Smith, who recalled the story in 2015. When Paul Smith arrived at Fort Meade in September 1983, he had been in the Army for 7 years. He'd worked as an Arabic linguist, an electronic warfare operator, and a strategic intelligence officer. Recently recruited into the remote viewing unit, Smith had no background in anything psychic or paranormal. He was a practicing Mormon who wore thick glasses and listened to heavy metal. He also possessed an artistic talent that helped recruiters identify him as a good candidate for the remote viewing program. In college at Brigham Young University, Smith had worked as a botanical illustrator and had mastered the art of stippling, creating complex images out of thousands of dots. Smith's first assignment in the Army's psychic spy program was to learn coordinate remote viewing from Ingo Swann. At first it went well, he says, but just a few months into his training, he felt stuck. I was having trouble acquiring and decoding the signal line, Smith recalls. He'd completed several stages of the protocol out at SRI in California and also at Swan's home in the Bowery in New York City. But Swann had recently told Smith he needed to loosen up. Stage one of the CRV training involved learning how to draw ideograms, quick, visual sketches of the target or symbols representing an idea. His ideograms were too stiff and scripted, Swann said, and suggested that the young captain place a Coke bottle under his wrist to relax his hand and get into the flow of drawing without intellect. It was weird, Smith thought, but it helped. When Smith heard that Bert Stubblebine, INSCOM's commanding general, was sending hundreds of Army intelligence personnel to the Monroe Institute for HemiSync training. He signed up. Smith knew quite a bit about the secret program because for several weeks now, he and a personnel specialist named Charlene Cavanaugh had processed the paperwork for those who wanted to attend the RAPT seminar. There was a waiting list, and when Paul Smith learned that he'd been picked, he was thrilled with the prospect. On December 2, 1983, with a weekend bag in tow, Smith headed over to the parking lot outside Nathan Hale Hall and boarded a bus headed to Monroe. His seatmate and roommate for the weekend, a former Morse code intercept operator named Edward Dames, had also recently been assigned to the remote viewing program. He was smart, dedicated, and very enthusiastic about remote viewing, Smith recalls. He had a reputation as an innovative, imaginative thinker, someone known for thinking outside the box to solve intelligence problems. To Smith's eye, Ed Dames looked more like a California surfer than an intelligence officer. He had a mop of sandy brown hair with a thick set of bangs across his forehead in a razor-straight line. He was an odd combination of single-mindedness and sardonic humor, says Smith. One moment, he could be gravely assuring you that the Soviets were likely to unleash vile biological weapons any minute now, and the next moment, he'd be making a rude or irreverent joke. Smith liked him immediately, he says. Dames loved to pontificate. Most of the four-hour trip, Ed spent talking about space aliens and UFOs, remembers Smith. Growing up in Utah as a strict Mormon, Paul Smith had been taught that intelligent life existed on other planets. Mormonism holds these extraterrestrial beings as creations of deity, he says, not the stuff of flying saucers or invaders from Mars. Still, he listened to Dame's talk and decided to remain agnostic on the subject of UFOs and Dame's obsession with the subject. He exuded confidence, seemed knowledgeable, and hinted at insider access to some of the details, Smith recalls. The Monroe Institute's main building, called the Center, was set on a sprawling grassy lawn lined with trees. It was three stories tall and warm and friendly inside, with wall-to-wall carpeting, soft, comfortable furniture, and wood paneling. Because it was built into a hill, participants entered on the middle floor, which gave newcomers a sweeping view of the center's great hall. All three floors featured wraparound balconies and double occupancy rooms. Each room contained a pair of sleep chambers known as Controlled Holistic Environmental Chambers, or CHECK units. Each unit contained two bunks with twin air mattresses and blackout curtains that could be drawn around each bunk for privacy. The CHECK units were wired for sound with built-in speakers that played Monroe's suggestions, HemiSync audio signals, white noise, and New Age music. RAPT participants were encouraged to lie naked, most remained clothed, in their berths, while Bob Monroe's voice guided them through various focus levels, starting on focus level 1, which was physical waking consciousness, and moving through higher levels. On focus level 12, a person could achieve expanded awareness. Focus level 13 was where no time existed. Focus level 18 was where unconditional love resided. Focus level 23 and above were inhabited by people who were already dead. The signals were mixed with music or white noise on tapes that lasted for an hour or 90 minutes at a stretch, Smith recalls. After each audio session, everyone gathered in the meeting area to talk over their experiences. imagery we encountered, or new insights, or, and this is what everyone was most anxious to hear about, the occasional report of something that might have been an out-of-body event. The sessions were always led by a trained psychologist. Other activities included strolling around the property and listening to Monroe's lectures. By day five, participants were expected to be prepared to move from focus level 15 to 21, a place where participants were most likely to enter an ethereal dimension, Monroe said. As the wrap session drew to a close, General Stubblebine came down from INSCOM with more than a dozen staff members and delivered a motivational speech. Then it was on to a final exercise. All wrapped participants were asked to assemble in the Great Hall for a group remote viewing session. Stubblebine wanted all the Army intelligence personnel present to collectively try to predict the future, a feat he believed was possible. The general had a lot of really far-out ideas, recalls John Alexander, and group precognition was one of them. Participants were asked to lie on their backs, close their eyes, and hold hands on the surround sound system. Monroe guided everyone through a series of relaxation exercises. Then came the questions, starting with, will there be a terrorist attack against a government facility in Washington, D.C. area in the next few months? The effect was jarring, recalls Paul Smith. It sounded as if Monroe were reading from a script. After 7 days of drifting without clocks, in a setting designed to approach serenity and bliss, he says, this sudden talk of terrorism was a shock. The way Smith remembers it, he and his fellow Army intelligence personnel did the best they could in these circumstances. They'd been given pens and paper, and many people began jotting down notes and recording whatever came to mind. Where will the next terrorist attack take place? Asked Monroe's disembodied voice. And finally, when will the next terrorist attack take place? Smith was new to the unit, hardly an expert on protocol, but the procedure struck him as not likely to be successful, he says. It began to remind me more and more of a game I had played in high school, the game where everyone lies on the floor with their head on someone else's stomach. Someone would giggle, and the bouncing of the laugher's stomach would set off the next person, then the next person, until in a chain reaction, the entire room would be laughing hilariously. The difference, says Smith, was that during the rapt seminar, everyone was seriously trying to look into the future. No one laughed. While this and other rapt seminars were taking place, 100 miles to the north, at Arlington Hall Station, Virginia, a 30-year-old intelligence analyst named Angela Della Fiora was one of the scores of INSCOM personnel on the classified waiting list, hoping for an opportunity to attend. Della Fiora worked at the INSCOM Watch Center as a civilian intelligence analyst. Her specialty was Central America, which meant that she wrote papers on current military crises in hot spots like El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, and Nicaragua. 1 week, she might be writing on the activities of leftist guerrilla forces and counter-revolutionaries. Another week, she could be profiling a country's political leaders. Before working for Army intelligence, Della Fiora had been with the FBI, entering fingerprints of convicted criminals into the new FBI database. She dreamed of becoming a special agent, but her eyesight was poor, and she failed the Bureau's vision test. When she learned that the Defense Intelligence Agency was hiring young civilians with degrees in political science, she leapt at the chance. The work at Arlington Hall Station was challenging, and she received high marks for her contribution. One day, she found out about General Stubblebine's paranormal program. As a special access program, it was a closely guarded secret, but her twin sister's astrologer knew about the Army's black program and told her. "From that moment forward," says Della Fiora, "I just had to get into the program. All these people were training to try and become psychic. Well, I am psychic. That's who I am." Angela Della Fiora was born in Coral, Pennsylvania, a poor coal mining town 50 miles east of Pittsburgh. It was a roadside community of a few hundred people, predominantly immigrant families from Italy, Czechoslovakia, and Poland, most of whom worked in the mines and coal yards up the road in Lucerne. Coral's few roads were named for trees and lined with small clapboard houses and trailer homes. The streets were unpaved. There were no sidewalks and no stores. The one business establishment in town was a tavern owned by Della Fiora's aunt and uncle. Her father, prosperous by coal miner standards, owned a beer distributorship in the next town over, across Highway 119. Bertha Della Fiora, a housewife, raised her twin daughters, Angela and Louise, in an environment filled with books and radio programs about mystical and supernatural subjects, including reincarnation, channeling, and ESP. She read books by Edgar Cayce, the so-called father of mystical healing, and Ruth Montgomery, a foreign affairs reporter turned past life advocate, and she encouraged the psychic abilities that seemed evident in her twin daughters. Angela remembered being psychic as a young girl, but in high school, her abilities waned. In college, they returned, owing to the encouragement of her chemistry professor, Carl W. Bordas. During World War II, Bordas had worked as a surgical technician with the Army and was part of the group that liberated Ebensee concentration camp in Austria. "The experience altered his perception," he said, and he began to think about the sixth sense. After the war, Bordas offered adult education classes in extrasensory perception that Angela, Louise, and their mother attended. Through these and other courses, Angela learned to access her third eye. "The third eye helps you see. It's a very old idea," she says. "It's located in the middle of the forehead. When you are being psychic, you have to open it up. When you are not being psychic, it's important to have it closed down." The third eye is an esoteric concept said to allow for perception beyond ordinary sight. In Eastern religions, it is described as an invisible eye located in the center of the forehead. In ancient statuary, it is often represented as a circle or an eye symbol carved on the forehead of the statue. In Qigong, third eye training involves focusing one's attention on the space between the eyebrows while moving through a series of physical exercises, postures, and poses. In literature, it is through the third eye that a soothsayer or seer commonly obtains supernatural insight, including prophecy. The concept of the third eye and the claim by a person that he or she has one is about as far from U.S. Army doctrine as a person can get, except for the brief period in the early 1980s when Albert Stubblebine, head of the Army's Intelligence and Security Command, was embracing paranormal concepts as a possible means of intelligence collection and encouraging the organization's staff to approach new technology with an open mind. Angela Della Fiora died in 1983. defied army protocol by asking around to see if anyone could help to arrange for her to meet with General Stubblebine. Word came back that this was impossible. Della Fiora was a civilian analyst, and Stubblebine was INSCOM's commander. Della Fiora recalls, "I kept pursuing this. I really wanted to meet Stubblebine. My management did not know I was psychic. I was working this on my own. Finally, word got to Stubblebine and back to me. The general wanted to see my abilities, so I went in and channeled for him." Channeling was what Angela did. She opened her third eye and the words came, she says. "He wanted to know about his future. I can't remember exactly what I told him. I wish I could," says Della Fiora. "I was nervous. He was the commanding general at INSCOM. My focus was to show him I am psychic and to get myself into the program." Stubblebine thanked Angela for coming and said he would see what he could do. In the meantime, Angela applied to take the RAPT seminar at the Monroe Institute and was put on the waiting list. After months of waiting, she was thrilled to learn she had finally been chosen to attend. Then a sudden change of plans. "I was told by my supervisor and his colleague, a fellow INSCOM employee, that they were going instead. So I'd lost my place for the RAPT seminar and was put back on the list." Della Fiora was disappointed. Until she learned what had happened during the seminar, what a disaster it had been. During one of the Hemisync sessions, the fellow INSCOM employee reportedly had some kind of breakdown. Agitated and threatening, he approached the institute director, Nancy Honeycutt, Bob Monroe's daughter, who was running the office that day, remembers Paul Smith. Sweating profusely, he removed his shirt and began toying with a ballpoint pen, suggesting that his martial arts training made it possible for him to kill her with it. Then he accused her of working for an enemy intelligence service. Nancy Honeycutt called for a staff member, and the two of them were able to defuse the bizarre situation. "I saw him when he was brought back to Arlington Hall," John Alexander confirms. "He was raving. He did not make any sense." Court documents indicate the man was sent to Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington for psychiatric evaluation. A classified investigation ensued. Army command was livid, recalls Dale Graff. They wanted to know, how did this happen? General Stubblebine quietly retired. Dale Graff returned from Moscow in the middle of the fallout. "I was the person who had to write up the report," he says. "It was a genuine mess. I had to make clear these were not our people from the remote viewing unit. They were under General Stubblebine's command. He had a lot of strange ideas." An unforgiving light was shined on the program. Angela says it made everybody paranoid at INSCOM. Angela was called into her boss's offices at Arlington Hall Station. How and why had she broken rank and gone to see General Stubblebine, she was asked. "Only then did I realize I'd made a terrible, terrible mistake," says Della Fiora. "Here I was, a young civilian, a female. I had gone way over my chain of command to get myself in to see the general. When my management found out that I went to Stubblebine and why I went to Stubblebine, real problems began to materialize." She had not considered the consequences. "I was so focused on getting into the psychic program, I had not seen the bigger picture," she says. "I am a quiet person. All my bosses knew was, here's this quiet person who gets up out of nowhere and goes to see the commanding general and tells him she has a third eye. My bosses decided, well, she must be crazy. I was told that they thought that the same thing that happened to the INSCOM colleague happened to me. Della Fiora received word that she'd been scheduled for a psychiatric evaluation at Walter Reed Hospital. I was worried I'd lose my job. What if I was locked up? I asked to see the staff psychologist, who made a few things clear. He said, "Angela, these people follow protocol. You skipped the chain of command, and you held a seance with General Stubblebarn." The staff psychologist wrote a letter on Della Fiora's behalf, she recalls. He said something like, "This is who Angela is. She has these abilities. This is a part of her. This is her belief system." Official documents reveal the psychologist to have been Colonel Dennis Kowal. Of Della Fiora, he stated, "I find nothing psychiatrically wrong with her. She was referred to the command because she had been participating in behavior that was actually encouraged by the commander Stubblebine, and they thought it was crazy. She was an automatic writer." But orders were orders, and Della Fiora's commanding officer insisted that she be evaluated at Walter Reed, so she went. I met with a doctor and told them my version of events. The doctor said I wasn't crazy and discharged me. Back at Arlington Hall, Angela was effectively demoted. Not officially, but it was obvious. I used to do a briefing once a week. Now I did a briefing maybe once every 6 weeks, she recalls. She was moved to an office in the attic. She did her job. She analyzed military crises in hotspots across Central America, wrote reports, and wondered what the future might bring. More than a year passed. Then, one day, the phone rang. It was an army captain named Paul Smith calling from the 902nd Military Intelligence Group at Fort Meade. Smith said he wanted to interview Della Fiora about a special access program. He couldn't say much more over the phone. How soon could she come down? Angela could barely contain her excitement. She knew enough about the program and the participants to know that Captain Smith was calling about the psychic program. After a year in the attic at Arlington Hall Station, she could hardly believe the good news. Chapter 19. The Woman with the Third Eye. It had taken 2 years for the fallout from the fiasco at the Monroe Institute to clear. The battle had been a contentious one, full of hostility, bureaucratic maneuvering, and strife. In July 1984, just weeks after General Stubblebine was forced into early retirement, INSCOM's new commander, Brigadier General Harry Soyster, canceled the remote viewing program. Then it came to light that Soyster lacked the authority to cancel the program because it had been authorized by the Secretary of the Army, which meant that only the Secretary of the Army could cancel it. In effect, the Army's psychoenergetics program was now up for grabs. The CIA considered taking the reins, then passed. According to declassified documents, so did NSA. For several months, the Assistant Surgeon General of the Army, Major General Garrison Rapmund, engaged in discussions to move the program under his command, within the Army Medical Research and Development Command, at Fort Detrick, Maryland, where the emphasis would be on testing the physiology of the viewers. But after several rounds of negotiations, the Office of the Surgeon General also declined. During this time, Dale Graff and Jack Verona had been lobbying for the DIA to absorb the psychoenergetics program in its entirety. RV has potential for U.S. intelligence application, they wrote, and the implications are revolutionary. Finally, on August 24, 1984, Secretary of the Army John Marsh authorized negotiations for transfer to the DIA. But this was the Pentagon, and so the bureaucratic entanglements continued for another 17 months. On January 31, 1986, the Special Access Program was finally given a new code name, Sunstreak. Jack Verona, chief scientist for the Directorate of Science and Technology, was still officially in charge. The chairman of the oversight panel was Donald C. Latham, Assistant Secretary of Defense. The unit's offices remained at Fort Meade. Sunstreak's new science panel included three of the nation's top physicists: Donald M. Kerr, director of Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico; Fred Zachariasen, professor of physics at Caltech, also a ranking member of the Defense Department's elite Jason Committee; and W. Ross Adeh, chief of staff of the research division at Veterans Hospital in Loma Linda, California. Three heavy hitters. And the official definition of psychoenergetics phenomena had been further refined. Remote viewing, RV, the ability to describe remote areas or concealed data via unknown mental processes, and remote action, RA, the ability to influence physical or biological systems via undefined physical means. During the first year and a half after the RAPT debacle, while the battle raged on, Joe McMonagle, remote viewer 001, was the only person actually assigned to remote viewing operations at Fort Meade, which were still functioning with funds left over from the Stubblebine era. Records indicate that he conducted 33 sessions on 7 different operations for clients that included CIA, NSA, and SED, the Army's Systems Exploitation Division. When McMonagle retired in the fall of 1984, the Assistant Deputy Chief of Staff for Human Intelligence at INSCOM awarded him the Legion of Merit for exceptionally meritorious service. After a short respite, he went to work at SRI, where he participated in research studies. Multiple sources indicate that he was almost certainly working for the CIA. If these files exist, they are still classified. Unlike a majority of the Army INSCOM and DIA files, which have since been declassified. The same mystery attends the files on Pat Price, also still classified as of 2017. By the time DIA took over the program, 5 viewers from INSCOM remained. They were Bill Ray, Paul H. Smith, Ed Dames, Tom McNear, and Charlene Kavanaugh Shufeld. They were all sent to New York City to be trained in the 6 stages of coordinate remote viewing with Ingo Swann. When General Stubblebine was forced to resign, the Advanced Human Technology Office had been shut down and the High Performance Task Force was disbanded. But one concept had not disappeared with Stubblebine, and that was the idea that Army soldiers and civilians could be trained to be psychic. The DIA had its reasons for insisting that this was the case. If remote viewing was a skill that could be taught, then ostensibly it could be unlinked from its magical, mystical, supernatural, and occult past. The expectation at DIA, says Dale Graff, was that charges of pseudoscience by defense officials, members of Congress, and eventually the public would be put to rest. But this logic was flawed, and it flew in the face of thousands of years of human history. The fact remains that until science can account for anomalous mental phenomena, prevailing opinion will keep it elemental to the belief system from which it sprung, the unknown. A declassified 6-page summary entitled Coordinate Remote Viewing, Theory and Dynamics, makes clear the uphill battle DIA was now facing. Coordinate Remote Viewing, CRV, is a psychic technique which permits a viewer to transcend time and space to view or perceive people, places, or objects without the viewer being physically present, reads the summary. But even a layman knows that transcending time and space defies the known laws of physics. How could remote viewers in training believe that they could view or perceive information from a distant place unless they accepted that divination was in play? And divination, by its very definition, involves seeking knowledge of the unknown through supernatural means. So to declare that psychic functioning was science and not the supernatural, or at least scientifically unexplainable, was to ask remote viewers to live in a catch-22, a paradoxical situation from which they could not escape because the rules contradicted the rules. The DIA issued memos of doublespeak. DIA has refined the process of teaching CRV to the degree that individuals possessing no known natural psychic abilities can be taught to remote view with extreme accuracy in a relatively short period of time, one declassified memo read. Another predicted that training would take approximately 6 months to complete, depending on the individual. CRV was divided into 6 stages, with each stage promising to increase the scope and ability of the viewer. And as per the training protocols, the stages must be completed in sequence because movement to the next stage of training is entirely dependent upon successful completion of the preceding stage. None of this proved to be accurate. Some of the most intractable problems came from the remote viewers in training. Invariably, students have questions, and questions require answers. Ultimately, the DIA would have to explain where the remotely viewed information came from. For this, DIA provided a cryptic, quasi-theoretical explanation for ESP, as hypothesized by Ingo Swann. Somewhere, perhaps in the unconscious mind, there exists what we will label the matrix, Swann's declassified summary states. The matrix knows no boundaries and has no limitations, he wrote. It contains all information about all things. It could be thought of as omnipotent, or you could think of it as a database, etc. Here was Ingo Swann, a committed believer in the magical, the mystical, and the supernatural, attempting to give generally skeptical military personnel a metaphor to work with. The matrix concept was to be interpreted as a figure of speech, akin to Carl Jung's archetypes of the unconscious, but some took it literally. Paul Smith recalls what happened when viewer in training Ed Dames first heard about the matrix and how excited he became. The viewers in training were sitting around the kitchen table at Ingo Swann's home in New York City when Dames exclaimed, "Why, that sounds just like the Akashic Records, a concept introduced by the famous spirit medium and occultist Madame Helena Blavatsky." Smith said he wasn't familiar with the concept, so Dames took the opportunity to lecture to the group. The Akashic Records were located on the astral plane, where all of human history and its memories are stored, Dames said. And according to the Edgar Cayce Association for Research and Enlightenment, the Akashic Records contain every deed, word, feeling, thought, and intent that has ever occurred at any time in the history of the world. The seeds of calamity were being sown. The original army screening protocols were meant to identify individuals whose minds were not closed to the possibility of psychic functioning. Dames exemplified an individual who appears to have been at the other end of the spectrum. His belief system was such that he was already fully invested in UFOs, extraterrestrial visitations, and the so-called Akashic records. To suggest to someone with this set of pre-existing beliefs that he could become a psychic spy for a top-secret military program was, in hindsight, a recipe for fiasco. After finishing their training with Ingo Swann, the viewers returned to Fort Meade, where Joe McMonagall was preparing to retire. McMonagall did not have a good feeling about the direction the program was headed, he says. Earlier in the year, when he'd been asked to help locate non-psychic people who could be trained to become psychic, he declined. There is no indication that training enhances remote viewing, McMonagall says. Perhaps bright and intelligent officers who were already prone to psychic functioning could become proficient, he wrote. But in the majority of cases, people with extrasensory perception are born, not made. Tom McNear was an exception. McNear, an intelligence officer, was one of the two original Swann trainees, starting in 1981. He immediately showed considerable talent, but his training moved slowly. It took him 2.5 years to get to stage 6, the level where viewers learn how to remote view a target, then create a 3-dimensional model of that target out of clay. McNear's clay models were so accurate in both concept and scale that photographs of them, alongside pictures of the target, were used in National Security Council briefings. By the end of his training, which included all 7 stages, Tom McNear had become so good at identifying training targets that Ingo Swann confided in colleagues, "He is better than me." But McNear didn't want to be part of the viewer unit at Fort Meade anymore. The program was a series of ups and downs. We had funding, we didn't have funding. 2 members of the unit died of cancer, and Rob Cowart, my fellow trainee and friend, was medically retired due to cancer. My wife said I had become very withdrawn and introverted. I felt the time was right to move on. I requested a transfer, McNear explained in 2015. The Army granted his request, and he went on to build a successful career in Army intelligence, where he still works as of 2017. In 1985, the Defense Department published a 41-page how-to manual, Coordinate Remote Viewing, Stages 1 to 6 and Beyond. Declassified in 2000, the manual's project officer, or author, remains redacted. The author was Tom McNear. Why did Swann insist that military personnel with no predisposition to psychic functioning could be trained to acquire extrasensory perception? The answer remains a mystery, though Joe McMonagall believes he knows why. In the late 1970s and early 1980s, says McMonagall, Ingo was forced into an impossible situation. The higher-ups wanted training methods, and they wanted it right then and there. This flawed idea eventually set the stage for tearing the unit apart. The irony was that as soon as DIA took over the psychoenergetics program, it parted ways with Ingo Swann. On January 31, 1986, what had once been Stubblebine's remote viewing program, by then codenamed Center Lane, was officially transferred from Army INSCOM to DIA. Jack Verona made administrative changes he felt were long overdue. He converted the job of branch chief and operations officer from a military to a civilian position. He allowed for the rotation of military officers who'd served previously to come back into the program. He reduced training time from 2 years to 1. Viewers who had been trained by Ingo Swann would now train new recruits. Assisting Fred Atwater was Ed Dames, assigned the role of operations officer, which meant it was his job to supervise viewers and handle administrative affairs. In 1986, there were 6 viewers and 3 taskers, individuals assigned to monitor viewing sessions. In July 1986, Angela Della Fiora joined the special access program Sunstreak. Unlike the other members of the DIA's psychic spy unit, she identified herself as psychic. Everyone else insisted they were not psychic, they were remote viewers. This immediately caused friction, Fred Atwater explained in 2015. To begin with, she'd gone around the chain of command to get into the program, went straight to General Stubblebine himself, and that is not allowed. Fred Atwater believed that is a violation of Army Code of Conduct. There are rules. People are expected to follow them. When asked to elaborate, he said, "She ignored what is sacred to soldiers, chain of command. In the military, if a soldier has a query, he or she is allowed to report only to a direct superior, who in turn decides whether that query moves higher up the chain. Angela Della Fiora did what is common practice almost everywhere in America except in the military. She went to the person she believed was in the strongest position to help her achieve her goal." Paul Smith says what incensed him most was that Della Fiora called herself a psychic, which made him and every other soldier wince. "At Fort Meade, we'd worked hard to establish ourselves as remote viewers," says Smith, "to separate the process from the terrible stigma of the occult." Della Fiora's insistence she was psychic flew in the face of all that, he says. "She read tarot cards and did automatic writing," he says, "and this was unacceptable to a unit of military men and women. I told her she had to lose the bad habits if she wanted to stick around," Atwater recalled. Her worst offense? The concept that none of the soldiers could accept was that Angela Della Fiora still insisted she had a third eye. In order to follow Sunstreak program protocols, Angela Della Fiora needed to be trained in the 6 stages of coordinate remote viewing. Declassified